Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, where this week Adam and I are joined by Patrick Coyle. Patrick is the founder and advisor at Novus Proximus. Patrick, I'll give you a very quick intro there. I mean, the company almost sounds like a transformer. Could you give us a quick overview of what the company does and and then we'll get into your background from there. But I'll be interested to hear about the company, first of all.
Yeah, and thank you, James and Adam, for your time. Happy to present the company. Novus Proximus means the new next in Latin. And what that is we're an advisory firm that is helping organizations get to the next level and be future ready today, particularly transforming the business of healthcare to create disruptive innovation for patients.
Amazing stuff. Well, I guess we'll rewind a little bit here and ask the question that we ask all of our guests, Patrick, and that is, look, how did you first get into the world of pharmaceuticals and clinical research?
So it's interesting. I always had this passion because my mother was in healthcare in all different lenses, whether she was the head of a VA hospital or working in an emergency room. So I had that patient centricity from a very early age and that passion cooking. And then my father was a chemical engineer. So you take that process that has to be there and you combine it with that kind of passion for patients. And that's what brought me to want to be a part of the healthcare industry. And having a backbone in finance and that approach, I really didn't see that way in, but actually through technology, is how I joined the pharmaceutical industry, deploying technology that would help improve process, be bolted on around process and people in the clinical trial space.
Okay. So when you mentioned that kind of finance backbone and technology there, where did that element come in? I mean, clearly the healthcare passion and kind of focus came from parents. Where did the finance and tech side of things get bolted onto that? So where did you start out in terms of your early career, as it may be?
Yeah, so I worked in parallel while going to school to find a way to help make ends meet and had a variety of different finance operational roles. And I had this curiosity that has fueled me early and fueled me currently, where I always want to know what the other part, how it correlates to what I'm doing, what I'm learning, what I'm thinking. And so it took me from one role to the next role to the next role. So kind of an evolutionary kind of stairway in financial operations. And I worked in the IT service industry for close to a decade. Technology was just a part of everything they did in finance. And eventually there started to work on financial solutions. Where I looked at framing the type of work we were doing, how we were working with offsite development teams, and this was in the early parts of the 2000s. So by the time I came into pharmaceutical industry, I realized that in some ways the technical capabilities were obviously behind the tech sector, and so I've always been a part of how do I make things more simple and make more automation. Bring more automation into the business to allow for that insight generation and that partnership and kind of strategic evolution.
Sure. And you mentioned kind of your curiosity was there from a young age, and that's perhaps assisted with this transition or growth along the way. Where do you think that, I mean, that curiosity, was that also, you think, from your parents, or where did that, do you remember when you first realized that you were quite a curious person and maybe asked more questions about how things worked, or has it just always been that way?
Yeah, well, it's helped me think about that through the lens of being a parent for three children myself, especially the youngest one, who's extremely curious. And so you start to think, is it nature versus nurture? But I think my parents always spent extra time explaining things to me. And I think because of that, it wasn't just because I told you so. And so that led to more curiosity. And I find that with my little one today, where, there isn't a simple answer you can give. She's going to find a way to call out a much more kind of approach to thinking through it to make sure that she understands and believes it too.
Yeah. So when you've kind of given an answer, they always want to go a layer deeper and then a layer deeper and then a layer deeper, which I think is incredible, really. And I guess if, as parents, if you've got the patience to go through that, I think it does entice that curiosity out of children. And clearly that's what your parents did, and that has allowed you to progress into what you are now, Patrick. So you talked about kind of that everything that you were doing on that finance and tech side of things allowed you to transition to the healthcare space, and perhaps to what you do now. But could you give us a quick, I guess, run through of kind of that trajectory into the healthcare sector and kind of a run through of how your career has brought you to this point?
Yeah, so it was a very opportunistic entry because I was in technology and had a backbone in SAP as an ERP and implementation and working around SOX, Sarbanes-Oxley implementation, and how to pull that through from an accounting perspective.
Yeah.
And I was with a global inks manufacturer company at the time when I got the call to come to Bayer, and it was through the integration of Berlex, former Schering and Bayer, that I got to work on this SAP deployment. And the finance was the backbone and the accounting was the backbone, but really I think they took a shot on me with technology. And so when I came into that deployment and took over, let's say, what we needed to do in the R&D space, it then allowed me entry into the business side. And that curiosity took me into the ins and outs of late stage research and clinical trial management, operations and development strategy, and contract negotiation, execution, site tracking, enrollments, and so it really gave me, and there was a broad swath of products in the portfolio, so I got to see a lot how a lot of these trends develop, and that's another part of of who I am is very analytical by nature. You'll probably put that back on my dad. So being able to see those clinical trials really, really helped.
Sure. What do you think it was that perhaps the healthcare and clinical research sector and companies that you joined weren't doing that you knew previously, and what was it that you brought to the table to help them make advancements there, improve their innovation, improve the way they were doing things? Of course, it would you must have gone in and that curiosity of why are we doing things like this, perhaps. But what do you think was the difference between the sectors, and what was that kind of secret sauce? But what was it that you brought to add value to what they were already doing?
Yeah, in the tech sector, everything they're doing is around product development, deployment, and paving the way with good process and structure in order to facilitate those deployments. And then you're deploying good project management around that to make sure that things are on time, on budget, and then everybody, all the resources are there, resource alignment. And of course, it's very important that you have the right champions and identifying those. So, I got a real passion for process and internal controls, which you sometimes find can be furthered through that process analysis. So when I came in, it was applying that same kind of structure to process, creating good process for technology deployment, and whether or not you get to have the budget for implementing new technology all the time, the good process streamlines and make things replicable and ultimately paves the way for automation.
Nice.
It's fascinating the way you describe that, Patrick, because I've also been involved in ERP implementations, but from the other side, from the farmer out. So working alongside technologists like yourself, and actually to your point, which is perfectly made around process. So we all know that clinical research is one of the most highly process driven industries that there are, and the fact that you came into the industry with all of that in your armory, as well as all the project management skills and all the other things, no wonder you made such a go of it, because actually that That is the secret sauce, James, exactly to your point as well.
Mm.
But as I say, working alongside people like you within organizations, particularly this was in a rare disease space, it's fascinating how there is so much overlap, isn't there, in process and approach and actually finding something that coalesces around a team.
Yeah, and to that point, I think specifically in James's question, what I saw was every site was doing things different. All the sites were doing things differently. Each one had their own process. Each clinical research organization had their own process, had their own reporting structure. And so on the manufacturer side, we had to find a way to level the playing field, right? And come up with the lowest common denominator. So it led me into really analyzing the types of data and working upstream to try and, you know, make it simple for the data collection and you know, not automation at that point, but creating good replicable process. I think from the accounting perspective, you know, as you do this and you start to understand all the contracts, it creates opportunity to come up with a common methodology for forecasting, common methodology for tracking costs. And at the end of the day, I boiled it back to lowest common denominators, which were patients, right? Mm. How many patients were enrolled? How many were supposed to be enrolled? What phase were they going through the trial? So, you know, a lot of great insights you can make into out of a very simplified story once you have the data.
Wow. Incredible stuff that you kind of came in almost. Just, I mean, trying to piece that all together, Patrick, must be a headache because you're probably trying to get different departments to change, different stakeholders to change. What would you say is the toughest part about pulling that together? Because it's all very good saying it and the theory behind it, isn't it? But then actually getting the adoption and the action from each individual is sometimes tough. What's the most difficult part of putting that together?
I think, like you said, it's the change management, but it's understanding, you know, I had quite a few customers and what are the common needs of the customers and listening, you know, being very good at listening and understanding what their individual needs are, and they're all different. But essentially, you know, what I was good at and am good at it is taking large amounts of data, synthesizing them, telling a story, finding the insights through the analysis. And so, you know, I was also mastering huge customer data sets. And so I think through that process, I'll put on my back this heavy kind of finance lift. And I don't want to say just finance, but heavy kind of working with Excel spreadsheets and data. And allowing them to do what they do best. And that's, you know, managing the clinical trials or whatever role that they played in, you know, pharmacovigilance or all the different functions to allow them the freedom. And then sharing the information back with them in dashboarding and really helping to increase the visibility of what's going on to make things actionable for each of them.
Yeah.
We love a dashboard, as you know. I'm a data guy, Patrick, right? We love dashboards, but also as you were describing that, I was thinking about a minimum viable product or MVP, as you might have, you know, heard James. But is that really what focuses you around that simplification? Is your minimum viable product? In other words, what's going to be the best for everyone for the broadest audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I like MVP better than lowest yeah. common denominator, but the LCD, I can use with the kids' homework too for that reference. Yeah.
I like it. And look, Patrick, like you've worked with some of the huge players out there, you know, like Novartis, Eastside, Bayer. You've now got the entrepreneurial bug clearly and started your own business. Where did the idea to go and do this yourself come from? Because I would imagine, and obviously you don't need to disclose anything, but if you're going in and you're, you know, bringing all this change management and doing such high level consultancy type work, you're getting paid a pretty comfortable fee for your services. So what's made you want to go and start a business? Where did that come from? At what point did you think, you know what, I'm going to give this a shot?
It's a great question. I think the last few years have taught us that, you know, maybe life looks different than it did before 2020. Mm. And so I think there's this constant kind of reevaluation, but my time to effectiveness and implementation was pretty short in these companies, because of my ability to kind of rapidly assess the situation. And then this diversity of experience, whether it's outbound or inbound, companies, Japanese, Swiss, German, American, public, private, gave me a very good understanding of the different needs. Because I think one of the challenges in our businesses is understanding the other side of the table. And yeah. So I felt like the more and more I was diversified, also very large multinational organizations and also, you know, biotech, emerging biotech. So I could have those conversations with a lot of different folks. And I've always had this entrepreneurial bug helping to set up a business that, you know, many years ago, that's still going today, my wife is running. And seeing her and scaling up the organization really, you know, gives me a lot of that confidence and how you do that. Plus, at the same time, in my last role, I had to build a massive kind of transformation, and bringing in the resources to be able to do that. And not just that one, I mean, in other roles too, but to bring in the different players to the table, external support, internal support, creating the partner journey, strategic partner journey with solution providers, bringing everybody to the table, and building that out. The only difference was doing it for one company versus, you know, being able to do that for many companies on the outside.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Look, you mentioned the company name, Novus Proximus. As I said, I likened it to something like a transformer. I'm a big fan of films. But what was the Latin meaning of that again? If you can share that once more.
The new next. New next.
Yeah. Okay. So look, let's talk about Novus Proximus then. The new next. What is the new next for your clients? What's the big value add? Who do you help? How do you do it? Give us a little bit of an overview here. I'd love to kind of learn a bit more about this venture of yours, because it sounds like your background is phenomenal. I now want to know about where you're going. What's the new next for you, effectively?
Yeah, thank you. And that passion for patients and for healthcare that I talked about earlier is what's driving me to. I hate access disparity in our healthcare systems. And as you know, globally, it's very different country to country. But there's quite a bit in the US today of that disparity. And so I think there's tremendous opportunity to bring better medicines, better availability, faster time to market, you know, for all these products out there to benefit patients. So the ability to do that for multiple organizations really will impact society in a positive way. And so unfortunately in our business, there's this huge learning curve, right? When you're an emerging biotech or clinical organization, and sometimes if you're more mature and there's significant changes, or product relaunches, if you're not working with the right partner who has that right experience, it can be daunting, and you make one little decision that sends you off in the wrong place. And always in my career, working in finance, I worked upstream to say, how do we not just help the bottom line, but how do we help the top line? And by the way, when we do that, it's doing well for patients. It means the patients are getting the right medicines, they're staying on treatment longer, you're having better clinical outcomes. And so for me, it's now working to help a company understand their circumstances and to move upstream and cross over from the financial to the commercial, and then how to create sustainability for clinical. So a lot of times you get to this point in a life cycle where, you know, you're going to be going off patent, and it's going to take, you know, the medicine's going to take a different path. How does an organization restructure? How do they think about the future? the earlier you can do that and shape that kind of flexibility, the better off. Mm-hmm. So I see a lot of companies where, you know, they're at a crossroad and they need someone to help them understand which way to go.
Right. So that's effectively the business model for you. It's advisory services to these biotechs, pharma companies. Does it include CRO sites level as well? Who are the kind of the target customers for yourself?
Yeah. So
all of the above?
Yeah, all the above. But in my career, as I moved up from very particularly from, you know, late stage research to clinical development operations, U.S. commercialization, and then to global commercialization, I actually followed one product, one molecule. And so I was able to understand what's needed in the beginning, what's needed at the end of the life cycle. Mm-hmm. And so I think for these organizations that are partners to the industry, there is so much opportunity to come at it from different angles to provide synergies and also, you know, what everybody's in this for is to drive innovation and help deliver for patients, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody that's in this business, that's what they should be in it for. But there's plenty of opportunity.
Sure. So look, I guess how's it all been going? I think when I first looked you up, the business is fairly new. What does day-to-day life at Novus look like at the moment, you know, in terms of like headcount, clients, like talk us through your typical day as it may be, Patrick.
Yeah, I think as an entrepreneur and a small business startup, you know, I've been in all those roles, having done that before already, but then also being in the C-suite, you know, every single day is something different. So it's no different than that. Sometimes you're on advisory calls where, mm-hmm. you know, you're trying to help solve problems, and other ones you're spending a lot of time and relying on the expertise of my network, right? Which is mm-hmm. a big part of this. And along the way, finding people in my career that are dedicated to the mission that I'm on and this purpose for patients, yep. And that are experts, right? So working through all those diversified companies, I found the best of the best. Mm-hmm. And so being able to leverage that kind of bench strength to work on these opportunities is really exciting. But there is no 2 days that look the same. We're definitely in a mode of scaling up. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a lot of technology that is going to be a big part of what we're doing. It is now, and it will be in the future, where organizations are trying to figure out what the right balance is. They need the advisory, and then they need the good structure and process we talked about. And so I bring this PMO, this super PMO project management organization, mm. which this structure allowed me to deploy over 15 technologies in less than 3 years in my last role. So, mm. you know, the good process has to be a very key part of this in making it replicable. And then on the technology side, we're technology agnostic, but the more experience we have with certain players out there, the more that we can, you know, inform how to make their products better, but also make the deployments better for customers. Mm-hmm. So because I think if everyone gets better at this on the supplier side and the manufacturer side, again, a lot of good's going to happen for patients, and that's what we're here for.
Sure. Adam, Patrick, we've got you on mute there, but now you're off.
Patrick, I hear a lot about agnostic systems, but more recently I've been listening to a number of conversations amongst people where companies are actually paying enormous software licensing fees that perhaps they didn't even know. Is that an experience that you've had when you've looked into organizations that actually they're paying out thousands and thousands of dollars to companies and not actually using their services as well? Because you talked about not just acting as a project management organization, but effectively going in under the skin and figuring out what they need and what they don't necessarily need. Has that been your experience? I'm just curious to know, because I hear a lot about it anecdotally, and I'm just curious to know what your experience is of that.
Yeah, that assessment, and we could do it in rapid fashion, is really, really critical, because a lot of the times, just through the course of business, whether you're a very small organization or whether you're a large kind of siloed one that's more mature, the continuity and connectivity between the groups suffers, right? And so, you know, what I was mentioning, the partner journey before, it's a concept you really don't hear about very often. And you just think of paying suppliers, you think of good contract management, you think of good procurement, but it's more than that, because you're going to see most of the same players very early stage, and you're going to see them much later. And in reality, they are your strategic partners. And the more and more we move to project-based work, contingent labor, more software deployments, AI, you know, that kind of that connectivity between the technology is really key. But the contracting and the partnership with those agencies is really, really critical. And so I call it the partner journey. And you know, when you're establishing, you know, your master service agreement and the statement of work, different functions sometimes have different statements of work. They're operating under different MSAs when they don't talk to each other. So it's very important, first of all, to catalog that, because you're going to drive opportunities strategically, not just financially. And so you'll see all the time, companies have evergreen clauses and they didn't even realize that they enacted. And so now all of a sudden, you know, you're backpedaling and trying to renegotiate only when you find out about them. But a lot of large organizations, you know, or they're deploying the technology, they know they are. But when you go and you talk to the users, you find out one or two people are using that technology, or they're taking the outputs and recreating, you know, into some other product, right? So being able to catalog the contracts, the suppliers, but the technologies and the uses for those technologies is really key.
Wow. I can imagine just, yeah, thinking about the complexities and the size of some of these organizations, just how much money and leakage there is with some of these systems, subscriptions, as you say, if you're on an evergreen contract of any kind and you're just not utilizing it. Okay, interesting stuff there, Patrick. I guess, so in terms of kind of moving forward for you as a business now, as I say, you've not been going sort of too long, but in terms of analyzing your own successes and challenges so far, you know, normally when I look at any business, I think they should be asking a couple of questions, which is, you know, what are you doing? What's working? What's not? You know, and then drop what's not and start focusing all that attention on what is, and you know, things are going to go better. What has been working best for yourself? Because as you say, once you put on that entrepreneur's hat, there's normally a few things that just don't go how you expected. So what are the biggest challenges you've perhaps faced in your own business so far, and how have you gone about overcoming them or adapting? I guess is I'm now interested to know.
Yeah, I think life is about evolving and adapting, right? I think that, you know, this, the challenges out there today in the market are great, right? I mean, in the manufacturing side, you have the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, and what the impact that's going to have on pricing and kind of lead product differentiation in high specialization areas, and that's coming in the next few years. So it's going to reshape the way that a lot of the healthcare system works, but it's still very much ambiguous, and so parts of it are very formulaic, but how each company is going to apply it's going to be very different. I think the economy, and you see what's happening with the banking industry, we're just, you know, unfortunately, some don't want to hear that, but we're just scratching the tip of the surface there. Mm-hmm. And you know, the economy is much more challenged. Inflation is a global problem. Globalization is also challenging at the moment. Availability of information. We are in a day and age where there's so much information that you can find, but it's dangerous if it's unverified, unvalidated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this, we're hearing a lot about artificial intelligence. And I think what I see is people are really struggling right now. The C-suite, many cases, the CEO, they need somebody to help them comprehend all these changes. that are so dynamic, they're literally day to day. And they already have a pretty full plate. So it's being, you know, hiring the right partner to come synthesize all of this and predict the events that are coming, because you got to get out ahead of it. But, you know, how to scale up your organization, how to stay lean, prepared for exit strategy, prepared for commercialization. You have to have parallel paths and, mm-hmm. and contingency plans, especially in this business. So I think funding for a lot of these companies is really strained at the moment. I'd say the reemergence of private equity in different ways. And I think it's going to be a very different landscape in the next few years for the healthcare system in the US.
Sure. Look, you've covered there, I guess, perhaps a lot of the challenges that are out there in the market and perhaps for your clients. I guess what I was interested in kind of with the line of questioning was kind of, have there been any challenges where you yourself have been blindsided a little bit and perhaps had to adapt what you're doing at Novus or not? Or, you know, if there's not, let us know. We'd love to hear kind of some of the big successes or achievements that you've had, you know, in the short time since going. Either or, if you could share a kind of both sides, amazing, or just one side.
Yeah, I think there's both. I like when I went from one of the biggest pharma companies to, you know, one of the very small emerging ones, your mindset has to change quite a bit, and you're flexing totally different muscles. Yeah. So, you know, I think in the first few months of the business, really flexing muscles in a very different way was very challenging. But then I think on the other hand, it makes it much easier to kind of roll up your sleeves and roll down your sleeves, you know, put the coat on and take the coat off. So I think a lot of that startup, you know, there's the startup pains where you wish you had something, you wish you had enough funding. You have to find it. You have to do as you've directed organizations in the past. You have to invest in yourself and invest in your business. And you got to get out there and knock on doors, right? I mean, the good news for me is I've helped a lot of people along the way be successful and help deliver for patients. And those people remember that. But you're always looking for the next client. I don't care how many you have.
Yeah. No, interesting. As you say, you've put in a lot of the legwork over the years. You've not skipped leg day, you know, and you're now reaping that kind of, I don't know, equity, if you like, of being able to reach out to friends, your network. You talked about leveraging your network earlier to get some form of repayment, even if it's not monetary, in order to help you achieve what you need to achieve. So I like that. And it's off because it is often hard, I think, to follow your own advice. It's all very easy, isn't it? Telling someone, this is what you need to go and do. You know, I think fitness plans and following diets, it's all very easy to say, go and do this. Following it yourself is sometimes a different story. So through this journey so far, it sounds like you are willing to roll your sleeves up, roll them down, whatever it may be. Have you changed your mindset, or what have you learned about yourself?
I think, you know, for me, there's a big difference and distinction between, you know, contracting, consulting, and advising, and what the future of work means for organizations. So I think the assessment is really, really critical, because like you said, I think your organizations don't necessarily know the situation they're in, not at every level. Right. Yep. And so there's a bit of a discovery. And I think, you know, helping people understand that is really critical, but most importantly, solving challenges and creating opportunities. And so I think there's so many companies out there just solving problems, but you know, what we do is create opportunities. And in that connectivity, specifically technology too, right? Whether it's a financial in analysis to improve, you know, the top line sales, or whether it's the connectivity of technology. There's so much API integration capabilities today, but you know, you don't see it deployed in a way, you know, some of the large organizations may have a massive amount of disconnected technologies. Some are SaaS, some are on-premise, and those aren't talking to each other. And so how to make sure they're safe, how to make sure that they're, from a security perspective, cybersecurity is running wild. Mm-hmm. How to make sure you're capturing the data from one system to the next, and then pulling it together for a full longitudinal view is critical. And so I think a lot of this, how to create value in the connectivity, is a lot of what we do and have to offer.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like a challenging job, but probably one that, I mean, definitely one, should I say, that keeps you active, keeps that brain active. So very exciting. As you say, no 2 days are the same. What are your goals or plans and predictions for you as a business over the next year? So like, let's say we invite you back on the show 18 months down the road. If everything has gone to plan, what are you going to be talking about?
So I think it's taking the new next to the new next, right? And what is that future? I think AI really hit the news, artificial intelligence, at the very mm-hmm. beginning of this year. But the more and more people I talk to, I don't think they understand the even simple use cases and applications. And not every company is AI ready. So I think if we can fast forward with the functional experts in as many areas as possible that I've met and collected along the way, that mm-hmm. we can get over here on a full-time basis. And really, we're working with the clients to move toward AI readiness. That's wow. really key, because I think in another year, they'll know what to do with it.
Incredible. Look, I guess, look, from my perspective as running a recruiting business, do you think then that people and companies are going to not need to start employing kind of head of AI, where they've got training divisions that can teach the existing teams, not to replace them, but how to utilize AI in order to do their existing job better, faster, smarter?
Absolutely. Absolutely. First of all, I think they're going to need to, the more and more people I talk to, the CFOs, in the finance realm, the C-suite, they're talking about these big management plugs, mm. right? In that they have to find a way to unearth and satisfy by the end of the year, because they're facing all the same challenges in inflation and availability of resources, and supply chain. So they're going to have to dedicate a portion of their budget to, let's just call it digitalization. Sure. And AI. And so I think you're going to have somebody in there as a partner. I think they're too early to have a whole function for it yet. But, change management has to come with that. And the people, the mindset, what has made me so successful in my career is really bringing people along. Mm. If you can't bring people along for the journey with their mindset and helping them develop at the same time, they're going to revolt. And they're going to say, no, thank you. And we can't do that, because there's too many applications that could be used for the benefit of all humankind. But it is going to take a little bit of work, because the first thing you think of is a robot taking over, mm-hmm. What we do. We all saw the movie Terminator. So we know what the bad part is, but I don't know if we really know what the good parts are.
Mm. Interesting.
Adam. I think. If I can also follow on from your point, Patrick, it's already happening, James. It's happening in Big Pharma. Big Pharma already investing in what they call data science, AI and machine learning, because ultimately they understand exactly that the secret magic is in the data that they already hold, but it's unlocking the magic to the data that they already hold, whether it's within their own clinical trial databases or in publicly held databases. I'm talking now about these broad data sets that are held across different geographies and different countries. That's where the real magic is going to be unlocked, I think. And wow. As I say, Big Pharma are already doing that, and they're already bringing in the talent, the young talent from universities with those skills and with that expectation that they will be hitting the ground running. And perhaps, working alongside people like Patrick and myself, and making our jobs more straightforward, but certainly giving more richness and value to the data that is already there in the public domain. Can I just bring you in on back on that point, Patrick, if I may?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm talking more cross-functionally, you know, how to leverage AI. But I mean, in the clinical data, you know, capture space, combining that with real-world evidence and data generation across countries, right? Across companies, across ecosystems, across countries, diversifying patient sets as much as possible, changing the way that clinical trials are managed with data capture at the patient level in and out of the clinic, right? It is, you know, we have these things available today. The widespread adoption is very low from my perspective. The bigger ones can do it very well and have a lot of money, but the little ones are the ones that really need a lot of help. And they don't necessarily have the funds to start groups or hire these officers or so. So I think it's more important than ever that they hire somebody who knows how to help them along the way. And you could really tremendously impact the outcomes of your clinical trials. You know, there's a lot of stories that you go look at poor diversification alone in the patient base, changing the outcomes post FDA approval, right? And you look at some of those and say, wow, that's a really expensive lesson to learn. How do you move that earlier, Justin? So, you know, how do you leverage the data that you have, especially if you're a more mature company? You've got a ton of data in your house. You know, it's under the bed, it's in the closet, it's all over the place. You got to put it in one place first. But then how do you leverage AI to tell you something, to make it predictive, and change, you know, trial design, trial outcomes? I think the speed at which our industry will be moving in a year or two, it's not a nice to have. It's mandatory.
Wow.
Is that what you see, Adam? Is that
100%. I mean, you've said all the things that I was thinking as much as the things that I hear on a very regular basis, but absolutely, absolutely spot on. And when I think about how clinical trials and clinical research has changed in the 20 odd years since I've been working it, you know, we were using paper and we thought faxes were great news 25 years ago, but look at where we are now. Look at what we have in the palm of our hand. You know, we have computers in the palm of our hand. There is just enormous opportunity and capability available to us now that was never there before. So if we don't act upon that, I think we'd be doing ourselves a disservice as a, you know, as an entire population, never mind all the things that we've been challenged with in the last two or three years since the pandemic.
Yeah, and I think also just one more point on that. I think once you bring a product to market and you have a patient, taking your medicine, what's going on? That goes to the real world evidence, you know, where you know clinical trials are very pure, but once it's out in the public domain, if you will, it's a very different story. And so I think it's going to be really critical to keep reinforming, you know, the journey with that real evidence. And there's a lot we can learn, but you know, in the distribution side, it's extremely challenging as well, because back to your fact story, there's still a lot of practitioner offices in the US alone that use faxes, a lot of them. And, you know, every fax is an opportunity for it to fly off and fall under the cabinet. And so there's a lot of different companies out there fighting to try and help make that more efficient and effective. But at the end of the day, the economics are not there for all of these practices to be able to really streamline and benefit from technology.
Wow. Sounds like, I mean, this is an area that we could go on for a whole nother podcast, isn't it? Talking about this and what's next and things. But we will save that for another day, gents. And look, Patrick, it's been a pleasure having you on to this point. But look, to wrap up the show, we always close off with a quick fire questions round. And I would love to pick your brain on a few of these. Clearly, you are a curious child, and that has led to a lot of success. But what would you say is the one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self?
Just be ready to embrace the unknown. Right. I wish that I was earlier on in my life much more ready to take that curiosity to the next level and embrace the unknown. Mm-hmm. The perseverance has always been there, but I think there was, you know, naturally fit well with me early on, especially in my career, this reluctance to take risk. But, you know, getting up in the morning and leaving the house is risky, right? So, you know, you can make anything a really challenging event, or you can make it really simple. The only difference is your mindset and your approach.
Like
you say, leaving the house is really difficult. Both James and I are working in the bottom of our gardens, so that made me chuckle. It's a great answer. What is the number one resource or book that you would recommend for our audience, Patrick?
The one I just started reading is Brené Brown, Dare to Lead. But, you know, I'm a big advocate in studying history. Every story in history is told from one perspective. So I think you need to round it out with multiple perspectives, any given story. But I think it's really just how can we lead with empathy? There's a lot of books about that. You know, we think that empathy is got to be something that's, you know, that's too ambiguous to incorporate into our own lives. But, you know, when you have a mission of wanting to do good and treat people well, it's amazing how good things happen, right? And so I think if we have more of that in the world, you know, every good will happen to everyone.
Awesome stuff. And look, you talked a moment ago or earlier on the show about kind of your network and the fact that you bring in good people. What would you say are the top three qualities that you value most when putting together these teams? If you could bullet point those for us real quick.
I'll talk about the soft traits. I mean, I think interviewing, I'd switched interview styles quite some time ago in my career, where it's less of the qualifications. You know, unless you're taking a test, you know, you could validate certifications, qualifications can be manufactured, definitely a lot more subjective, but things like integrity, things like perseverance, and individual expertise, not, you know, on a specific topic. And if the expertise isn't there, is the willingness to go get it, right? Mm-hmm. We all can't be experts in everything. And if you live long enough, you start to forget stuff, unfortunately. But that willingness to kind of go back at it and constantly refine, because back to the comment about history, you know, sometimes it repeats itself a lot, mm-hmm. But other times it never looks the same way twice. So, you know, your perspective on, if we were talking about real world evidence and data collection, leveraging AI, we wouldn't be having this conversation 4 years ago. You know, it would be a pipe dream. And should we be having more of it today? Yeah, we should, but we're not yet. So, you know, in 2 years, it'll be like old hat.
Awesome. Adam, great back answer. To you.
What is your favorite thing outside of work, Patrick?
Spending time with the family. You know, I try to make sure that there's enough time for everybody when they need me. I think it's really important being there and helping to have them prepared for the new next is also really critical. You know, and I think for our children, you have to teach them well. So trying to spend as much time with them as possible to make sure that they're on the best path for success. But I love theology too. Do a lot of studying of theology and philosophy.
Awesome stuff. And look, finally, and to close the show here, Patrick, what would you say is your number one golden rule for both life and business at present?
Treat others as you want to be treated yourself. You know, it's amazing that there's so many lessons that we learn through golden books and when we're kids. I don't know that they're all being taught the same way today. Some of that's good, but I think some of that's bad, because the stories and the fables were very simple, right? It was very simple. But I think that, like, you know, again, I think there's lessons we learned that we should make sure live on with our children and with the future. But treat others the way you want to be treated.
Amazing stuff. Well, look, Patrick, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Huxley Morton podcast. Look, for anyone that wants to reach out to you or learn more about your services, what you can do for them as a business, where is the best place to get you? How should people be reaching out?
Yeah, thank you. I think the website is a really good one. Mm-hmm. Emails, you have to remember, but hopefully Novus Proximus, you know, putting it in the link, and NovusProximus.com is a good way to start.
Fantastic stuff. Well, look, absolute pleasure having you on the show, Patrick. We will follow your journey and perhaps try and get you back on in 18 months' time to see where we are then with AI and the rest of it. But thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, James and Adam, for having me. It was really a great conversation. I enjoyed our time together.
Awesome.